Amateur Presentation.
Christopher, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about Bring Them Down. The first thing I wanted to ask you about was right now, what's going on now with the movie in terms of its release, but also what did the Toronto International Film Festival screening mean to you in presenting the film to an audience that's both critics and industry, but also the public?
Oh, the screening in Toronto was firstly the most terrifying experience of life. I was so nervous. I transcended nerves into terror, and I had an out of body experience on that stage as I was introducing the film with Barry and Chris and Colm, and so I was incredibly nervous because no one had seen it. I mean, like, we'd shown it to a few people, but. Like, it never, you know, people that had no idea of what they were stepping into. Chris had seen it, but Barry hadn't seen it, and Colm hadn't seen it. And so I was incredibly nervous, and I sat in front of them, which kind of felt like the wrong way around, but I could hear them like really getting into it and loving it and laughing and feel their tension. And it was the most special, one of the most beautiful things that ever happened. You know, I didn't watch it with an audience for a good couple of months afterwards because I was protecting it like this kind of special, like a torch, you know, that I was carrying around with me because it was such a beautiful moment. And now, yeah, we had this amazing run, festival runs, where we picked up a few awards and played it in different countries, and people really responding to it in such a positive way, and always talking about what it meant to them, which was really special for me. And now, you know, we're a week away from a theatrical release, the 6th of February in Latin America, and the 7th of February for North America, Canada, Ireland, and the UK.
Were you able to engage with the film differently watching it in a festival setting? Because you've spent nearly a decade of your life making this film, and with those nerves, were they able to dissipate as you were watching the movie?
Yeah, they did. I mean, I was in a bit of a fugue state, I guess. I was in this sort of strange world, and I was very, like, you become very aware of, like, the whole room. And, you know, I've done it with short films, and you can hear somebody breathe, and you're like, oh, why are they breathing? You know, sorry, why are they sighing? Why are they clicking their teeth? And but it was such a huge auditorium, and it was so full. I just kept leaning into it, and I could feel people's engagement with it, and I could feel tension. I could feel like them really going on the ride, and it was kind of remarkable. You know, I'd never been in that situation before, so I wasn't really paying attention to the movie. I was paying attention to the audience and sort of just absorb it, like watching the movie through their reactions. But I have like since then I've sat down and it's fascinating to watch it. Some places people really get, like, some people get the humor and have that permission to, once there's the permission to laugh, then it becomes a different experience. And some audiences take it really, really seriously, and that's a different experience too. But all seem to be, you know, enjoying the fact that they're taken on this kind of propulsive ride.
Absolutely. And I felt that watching the movie. I was curious, because this is your feature directorial debut. Are there any feature length directorial debuts that you have watched in your own movie going experiences that have creatively inspired you, or just from the point of view of looking at other people's work that, you know, really developed their voices in their first film, or you felt that their voice was coming through?
It's a tricky one. I mean, I've had this conversation before, and then I found out talking about people's second features. It's like, you're like, oh dear. But I really did feel that with Lynn Ramsey's first feature. I was such a fan of her short films, and when I saw Ratcatcher, I thought it was extraordinary. And the same with Andrew Arnold. And then, you know, I think David Lynch's first feature film is masterpiece. You know, I just I sitting through that film in a cinema is kind of extraordinary, and just the freedom and the just the artistry and like just pulling an audience in, and you have no idea what's going to happen next. You know, it's just extraordinary. And I think I felt like that way when I saw. I remember taking my mum to see the following Christopher Nolan's film in a cinema in Manchester, an art house cinema in Manchester. And for no reason, as it was the thing that was on next, you know, we'd been for a cup of tea and then there was this movie on. And I feel like you could feel everything that he's done since in that moment, in that film. So yeah, there's some incredible debut features, you know, out there. You know, people punch really hard in that first. I guess because it takes such a long time, and it's kind of so much inside you, and then it's like I think you respond to those filmmakers that are like, it might be my only chance, you know, and this is, I'm going to leave nothing. Nothing. I'm not going to leave anything. Yeah, every single idea I've got, I'm going to try and squeeze it into here because I want to try this. I want to do this. I want to do that. And for that reason, you know, sometimes they really do hit. But even when they don't hit those heights, if they've had that ambition, there's something really exciting and sort of effervescent about them.
Did you feel that way with Bring Them Down in terms of wanting to put everything on the screen that you wanted to represent in terms of how you were feeling or the themes that you were interested in exploring? Because, there, you know, you've talked in previous interviews about having also developed another script prior to this that was going to be your first film. And did this feel like your first film because you were working on that other project beforehand?
I think I'd worked quite hard as a writer. You know, I'd worked in the camera department for a long time, so I kind of felt like I understood the, you know, the structure and the process of making films, and I understand and being it, you know, spending a few years as an operator gave me this kind of different way of writing, as like through image, through creating image systems and around with characters within them, and that's kind of something that I'm very interested in, about embedding and how I embed character into story and into the frame. But I had written like quite a few. I've written like four featured films before I wrote this one, and I think I wrote another six whilst I was trying to get this made for different, you know, for like to earn money. And you know, those nearly got made and didn't, and this one nearly got made and didn't, and you know, so I've been sort of trying to cut my teeth as a writer to try and earn money, and with the idea that I just wanted to direct, you know. And when I first had that idea, I didn't know anybody who could write, so I sort of buckled down and tried to teach myself how to write, so I had something to direct. So I guess it did in a sense, but I think that having that, you know, it's the cheapest way to make a film is to write one, because it is alive in your head. It's like, it's there. It's like, you can just, you
the imagination.
Yeah. You can just, you know, yeah. And you can write a scene. You can do whatever you want. You can be wherever you want. You know, there are restrictions when you're thinking about what that might be and how you get that made. You know, it's like, there are restrictions that you need to put yourself. I was listening to I can't remember his name, the guy who's made Companion. Is that it's come out?
Oh, Drew Hancock.
Yeah, so he's the same. He was the same. He's like his first spec was like a $200 million science fiction film, and he was like, "Oh, no, I'm making this off me, who nobody knows." And then he's gone through this period of cutting his teeth as a writer, and gets this opportunity, but I'd made it so that it was contained, that it was makeable, but all those skills that you learn mean that you have got more control and more understanding of character and how to, you know, how to build a story and what is important within that story.
Yeah, I remember Orson Welles even talking about like the thing that he appreciated the most is that the sheer ignorance of making a first feature film, because you don't know what the limitations are until you start making them, you know, and that's the thing that I've always kind of been inspired by. You brought something up, and I wanted to ask you this, and please let me know how much you can talk about or feel like you want to share. Having started as a camera operator, but adapting to screenwriting due to health concerns, did you feel as though you were starting from scratch? And were there any aspects of that prior position that helped inform your work as a writer director?
Yeah, I mean, I was starting from scratch. I was really poorly for quite a long time, and I started writing most, you know, I was like, I didn't know what else I could do. And I was, you know, I'd loved being in that world, even though it wasn't quite the job that I wanted to do. And it hadn't scratched the itch of wanting to be a storyteller. And something, you know, a dyslexic growing, you know, as a child, I really struggled with language and words and writing and spelling and reading, you know, but I would tell people, like careers officers at school, that wanted to be a writer, and like, what's that talking about? But I had this desire to want to tell stories, and I think, you know, a lot of things happened to my brain while I was ill. I had a meningeal encephalitis, so it affects you, infection in the brain and in your spine, and when I started to write in through the process, my relationship with language had changed. There was a freedom, and it might have come from something that's physically changed my brain, but also I was always very self-conscious, and I was always a little bit embarrassed, you know. I was like, and I think that came from struggling, you know, at school, and like the embarrassment of showing something and letting someone read something and tell you what they thought. But being that ill, being that close to death, And it is quite liberating, because there is nowhere else to go. It doesn't get as bad as that, you know. And so that gave me the opportunity to deal in and say, right, this is who I am. I'm not embarrassed anymore. And so so something changed in my relationship with words, but something really changed in the way that I accessed who I am and how I feel about things, and will write unapologetically about how I feel and what I'm exploring. And that is helped by the idea I don't feel like I'm ever going to tell an audience my stance on anything. I'm going to question myself. I'm going to question my characters, and I'm going to question the audience and allow them to make their own decisions and come to their own point of view about whatever the thematics is that I'm exploring.
Was there a question that came up often in your writing process that you were thinking about in terms of pondering? Because I do appreciate what you're saying, where the answers are never as interesting as the questions themselves.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to do about toxic masculinity, a lot to do about how you what you pass on as a parent onto your child and your responsibility there. And with the major, that's within the sort of family dynamics and about father-son relationships. You know, I was exploring my own relationship with my father. And as I started to write this, I became a father myself. And so it changed, you know, you start to evaluate and think about, you know, just how difficult it is to be a parent, and as you're trying to, you know, carve out a career and earn enough money to keep, you know, keep things going and be around and be attentive and give yourself time to have fun and play, and the pressure of that. But then across the board, it was this idea of, once you've started a war, what does it take to finish war? And, you know, we were in a different space in the world at that point, and it just feels that as we've been moving forward and trying to make the film, it's become more and more pertinent as we go. You know, there's so much more conflict, or it feels like there's so much more conflict in the world, and so that the relationship of the space that we're in and what is our responsibility as an individual to that global conflict, about how we treat our neighbors, how we treat our loved ones, how we treat the people in our community, you can make a difference, you know, to the fabric of the world, I think.
Absolutely. Well, I do have to wrap with you, but thank you so much for taking the time to do this. Yeah, congratulations on Bring Them Down.
Thanks, man. It was really good to meet you.
Good to meet you as well. And thank you so much for the time. I really do appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Eric.